Hello, and welcome to Live Like the World is Dying, your podcast for what feels like the end times. I'm your host today, Margaret Kiljoy, and today I have a guest on that I'm excited about. You might have been noticing that I haven't been hosting as much, because that's because I burned out really hard, and not on the subject, but just in general. But I'm trying to get back into it, and part of the reason I'm getting back into it, I've been really excited to have Tyler on, who we're going to be talking to in a minute, because I'm really excited about what's going on in the preparedness space, and it's rare that I get to bring someone on who's just also in the preparedness space and has similar ideas. I think you all will be really excited. And so, well, I was about to say without further ado, but there is more ado. This following ado is that we're a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts. And here's a jingle from another show on that network. Da-da-da-da.
The Anarchist.
Radio.
Berlin.
From across the pond.
So it's the Anarchist Radio Berlin.
With audios in English, Spanish, and German.
And please,
don't mention the war.
You can find us at channelzeronetwork.com and aradio-berlin.org.
Okay, and we're back. So, if you could introduce yourself with your name, your pronouns, and then I guess just like a little quick introduction to what you do.
So my name is Tyler. I am started a company called Dark Winter Concepts. Pronouns are he, him. Basically what I have started doing is I noticed there was a huge void in the prepping homesteading space when it came to making it accessible to newcomers or anyone who is just in a marginalized community. And it was really just so important for me to take all this stuff that like is natural to me just from my upbringing, and just make it accessible to people who actually need it, the people who are under pressure in society already.
Hell yeah. Do you want to talk about, I have this question here of like how, what got you into it, but you've already said it's how you grew up, but do you want to talk about that a little bit more? Like what got you into preparedness and homesteading?
It's kind of a funny story slash full circle with the name. So I grew up in very rural Pennsylvania, growing up on a farm, but moved around a lot afterwards at working and all that sort of stuff. But then I was kind of coming into, you know, wanting to be able to use all the skills that I learned growing up. And then I had a weird gateway experience playing the video game The Division, where the idea of a personified trained individual could use their skills beyond just like, you know, tactical combat, all this sort of stuff, but could use all these technical engineering and other skills to maintain stability in communities after a disaster. And that checked a lot of boxes for me that like a lot of other games of that type just really don't. And so that kind of triggered just an interest as like kind of exploring like, well, where could I be applying these skills? Like, how could I be like doing this? And as time went on, I started to explore it more. And once we got out to West Virginia, where, I mean, losing access to resources is pretty common here anyways, it kind of just became a part of life. And then obviously COVID happened, which, I mean, thankfully we had kind of already started because that made it a good wake up call, but we were much less affected than a lot of folks were. But after that, like we got serious about it and, you know, started developing those skills, had space to practice them and decided that, you know, as someone with the privilege to have that space to practice skills, to try out things, that I should be using that privilege to share and to share that learning experience and failures, because there's been plenty of those. But I just felt like with the privilege that I had, it was really like my responsibility to share as much knowledge and of my own journey as I could.
Okay, so I find this really interesting. I really like, you know, framing it around as like having the privilege to have the space to try out these things. And it's interesting to me because, I mean, obviously in preparedness space, living rurally is generally looked positively upon. I actually don't think there's an intrinsic, it's not necessarily better in rural or suburban or urban. I think they all have advantages and disadvantages. I clearly like rural, but I hadn't heard of this phrasing before, thinking about it, like the privilege of the space to try things out. Like, you mean in terms of how you can actually just like, oh, I want to try and build a thing. Well, no one's going to yell at me if I build this. I don't have to go do it in the parking lot behind my apartment building. Is that kind of what you mean?
Yeah, that. And then, I mean, when you get down to things like learning like fire starting, like I can literally just step outside my house and start a fire if I want. And that's not, I don't have to worry about a cop driving by. I don't have to worry about upsetting neighbors. Like I can just go do that. I can go walk out of my house and go into the woods and learn to forage and learn about the plants that are in my space. The ability to have like space where I don't have to like plan a camping trip to go be outside in nature. Which I mean is obviously part of my prepping being in nature because this is where I'm located, but to have space to try out survivalist skills, to try construction skills, to, you know, do like more defensively minded capabilities and like practice those my own time and not have to arrange like a range day or anything like that. It's a privilege to have this much space. And it's something that I've been trying to make the most of.
No, that makes sense. I think everyone knows this. I'm also in West Virginia. It was actually part of why I was really excited to talk to you. But I tend to think about like what I currently don't have access to, right? Like I have access to space and it's really nice. And I actually need to remember to focus on that. I think about how like I don't have to plan to go learn camping things. I have to plan to buy anything I can't get at Walmart. You know, That's the main downside I've run across. I mean, that said, I mean, I know where to buy gravel near me. And if I lived in the city, I might not know where to buy gravel, but I wouldn't need to buy gravel if I lived in the city. So.
Yeah. And I think that comes down to like when you live rurally, like, yes, you do have space and space to cultivate your own resources, but you do have to really plan where you're getting other resources from. And I mean, like one of the biggest things for me is like you have space, but it's harder to find people to connect with as a community. And that's something that you have to be really diligent about because it is really easy to just like stay out here in the woods and not go anywhere ever. But it is something obviously as long-term prepping plans needs to involve other people at some point. So it is something you have to be really intentional about. It's not just going to happen very naturally.
You ever seen that show? Is it called Doomsday Preppers or Preppers or Doomsday or what? That fucking reality TV show? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
There's this thing that they always have in it. I mean, it's basically a how-to guide about how not to prep, and at least the like I've watched like three episodes, but they all live in the suburbs of the city and they're all like, this is my like bug out plan. This is the property I've gone and bought in the backwoods or whatever, you know? And it's interesting to me because I think about it, you mentioned the community thing. And I just think about how my current crisis plan involves leaving my rural space to go to a specific place to connect with specific people. And then depending on the situation, come back here. Right. But it's like, I have a like get out of the rural area plan, you know, because it's like, well, I care about people.
Right. Yeah. And that's something we've talked about as well. Like our main plan is for other people to come to us because I mean, even if we run out of space in the house, like we have space for tents, we have space for people to sleep in their cars. Like that's, we can accommodate a lot of people. But there is absolutely like contingencies for someone who may not be able to get out. Maybe, you know, we need to go and collect someone and their stuff and, you know, their pets and whatever. And that's a huge consideration that you can't leave for last minute. You know, you do have to have a plan for it that everyone's aware of.
Yeah. Okay. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, one of the pieces of feedback I get or people, things that people are nervous about is people of different marginalizations talking about a fear of rural areas and rural living. And I actually think West Virginia has a particular reputation around this, which is funny because from my point of view, West Virginia is specifically the better Virginia in that it did not fight for the Confederacy. And that's why West Virginia exists. But it's not a utopian place in a lot of ways. And I can speak about gender you know, and I can speak about my situation, but I have, you know, when my friends who are people of color and especially Black folks are like nervous around rural areas, I don't know what to tell them because anything I say is like, well, there's, you know, Black people in the town nearby, but actually where I live, for example, a lot of Black people live in town and not as many Black people live out in the hills around the town, you know? And I wanted to ask you about your experience, both your experience living where you do and like what you would say to someone who, not be like, everything's fine. I'm just like genuinely curious, like how things are and like what you would say to other folks who are racially marginalized about rural areas and rural living.
My experience, I mean, there's a few things that I would recommend. If by some situation you are moving out and you do like, you find a place rurally and you go out and you are someone who is just not white. One thing that I found and one thing that I prioritized really early on was just like meeting my neighbors and like introducing them like, hey, I am supposed to be here. I'm supposed to like, I live right over there. Like, yeah. Because I mean, at any point I might be, you know, out like on the backside of our property in the back of the woods and, you know, be seen by a neighbor who like wouldn't see me coming out to the mail, like completely different areas. And so making sure that like the people that are around you kind of like know that like you live there, as much as it might feel kind of dehumanizing to have to do so, prioritizing your own safety is really important and not focusing on like the, you know, how it should be. So making sure that the people around you know that like that you moved in, that you're supposed to be here, that you live there. And then past that, like my biggest experiences have been primarily positive. Like my biggest thing, I think, for people moving, if you're moving to a rural area for the first time and you're a person of color, the biggest thing I think that will potentially trigger a negative response is more so about how you behave than how you look. And then that is to say, not that people should like kill part of themselves and like hide and like that sort of thing, but it's more so like, especially for West Virginia, do you act like you're from the city? Like, are you pushy with customer service people? Like, are you really fast paced? And as from a rural perspective, do you feel like impatient and pushy? You know, 'cause how you would act in, you know, a deli line in Manhattan is going to be way different than how you should act at like Tudor's Biscuits in West Virginia. You know, so you're going to have very, very different experiences depending on how your rhythm meshes with the people around you, basically. Because I mean, even being out here, like, I mean, for where I am, I'm very, far as I can tell, very much the only person of color, like on my road, like for sure. But like, there's a Black guy who works at like my tractor supply, and like everyone loves him because he's, you know, he's super charismatic, but like you can tell like he probably grew up reasonably well around here. But like that's kind of the big thing, is that like you're probably not going to get too negative of an experience because of how you look if you're a person of color, as opposed to how people perceive your behavior, which again is in many ways unfair, because if you're just from a more vibrant culture than rural West Virginia, and that vibrance is part of who you are, like I certainly don't want to encourage people to like, you know, hide themselves, but like just to be kind of self-aware as how their behavior may affect other people and how it may draw a reaction from them. And just understand that could be a possibility. But I think overall, like my experience has not been bad. Like I have not had really any like bad experiences related to race out here. Growing up, I definitely did. But since being out here, like really nothing overly negative to speak of. Overall, I think West Virginia especially, like there are obviously a lot of remnants of the people who are, like, as you said, like West Virginia didn't fight for the South, but there are a lot of people who are kind of resentful of that fact, people who wish that they had. Like those people definitely exist. But I think like a lot of seemingly emboldened, like racists, transphobes, a lot of folks, like, are very different in person than they want to be perceived online, which is where we perceive them, especially if you don't live in a rural area. Like, you see, like, the Facebook posts, the TikToks of how people are projecting their hatred, right? It's been my experience that most of all around here, like, people just want you to kind of go about your business and let them go about theirs. Like, yeah. They're polite. They'll, you know, chat with you if you're sitting at the, like, local coffee shop. I really don't have any overly negative things to say other than just, I mean, you just need to be careful, you know, because there is the possibility that the person that you meet at the bar and maybe divulge a little bit too much about where you live, like, there's, you know, the possibility that that person's a bad actor or knows someone who is and is willing to kind of share that information. So being a little bit more guarded about, like, I mean, similar to how you act online, like, you don't give out, like, the street that you live on or that sort of information.
Right. Like, both of us actually live in Southeast Ohio, but we're pretending like we live in West Virginia to throw people off. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's being aware and guarded. It's being just aware of how your behavior here will be received differently than how it is in a major city where there's obviously just so many people from so many different backgrounds and everything that, like, there's no, like, one that stands out or that people react poorly to in that sense, where cities are more of a melting pot. It's just being aware. It's being a little bit more alert than maybe normal or than is maybe fair to be.
Yeah. No, that's interesting to me how much it maps to my experience as a queer white person living here, where it's a very similar thing where I'm more guarded in a lot of ways living here. I'm more careful about, I don't necessarily tell people exactly where I live, or I often don't tell people exactly who I am, right? About half of the people around here am I specifically out to as trans. But I'm, you know, to the people I'm not out as trans, I'm walking around with bangs and braids, but I'm also walking around with bangs and braids and a, like, Carhartt coat. But I'm also wearing a fucking mask, and that's not normal around here, you know? And it's like, and my experience has been that, I've probably talked about this on the show before, but my experience has been that once people got the sense that I wasn't, like, trying to change the neighborhood culturally, like, I, you know, they're like, okay, well, that weird queer person has guns and a pickup truck and isn't trying to tell us that we can't have those things, you know, like,
yeah,
it's been more okay since then, you know? And no, it's interesting. It makes sense to me. I was reading Reddit about this issue, and someone was like, hey, we're a mixed race couple and we're thinking about moving to West Virginia from California, you know, because of, you know, some family thing in the house or whatever. Are we going to get shit for that? And everyone in the Reddit comments in, like, /r West Virginia or whatever was like, no, you're fine. Oh my God, wait, you need to change your license plates. Change your license plates as soon as possible.
That is the absolute first thing I thought. I was like, they're going to get a way worse reaction to the license plate than anything else.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then I want to also talk about another space that you are in, is that you're in the prepper space, and you're in the prepper space in kind of a, at least my observation of it, in the kind of homesteading tactical corner of prepper space, but from this point of view of, specifically being someone who's inviting people of, like, marginalizations and or people who are just new to that space, like being the opposite of a gatekeeper, being an usher into that space. And I'm wondering kind of what brought you into that space in particular, because that space is, like, it's the, like, forbidden zone of prepper land, right? It's the one that we think of as the most right wing.
Yeah. Honestly, it kind of happened naturally. So basically, I I kind of started, I mean, everything kind of started on Instagram with an account there, which I really just created to try and just like meet more people, just like connect and network with people, because I was living in relative isolation, like sort of, I mean, was moving my way politically left at the time, and was just like moving kind of further into isolation in that way as well. And just trying to find like people to connect with over like guns that weren't, you know, going to bring their like laser engraved Trump revolver or like anything like that. Like really just started like looking to connect with people. And then kind of the more that I shared about like what life is actually like here, like stuff that I was doing, projects I was working on, like it was, again, kind of from a point of privilege where like all that stuff is just like completely unremarkable and part of natural life to me. But people were like really interested in it. And like they wanted to learn like, where did you learn how to do that? Like I'd love to do something like that someday, blah, blah, blah. And just kind of from thing to thing, I just started realizing that like a lot of these people who are asking are people who are in marginalized communities, especially marginalized and impoverished communities. So people who are looking for ways to build things because they can't just go out and buy the ready-made version, right? They can't just go out and buy the like $800 chicken coop from Tractor Supply. Like they want to learn how to build something on their own. And kind of the more I started connecting with people and just realizing that like there's all these people with so many good intentions, like so much they want to do in their neighborhood, in their community. And they just don't know how yet. And it just seems to me is something that's so natural and easy, but I can see that like there's this huge knowledge gap for people between what they want to accomplish and what they know how to accomplish. And the only real difference was just access to the resources to learn how, because that's something that I've been really driven about is making sure that like, I'm not trying to create like a centralized, like, oh, you need to come to me to learn this. Like, I'd much rather like, oh, here's this YouTube channel that like, you can learn everything you need to learn about like woodworking from here. You can learn everything you know about like blacksmithing from here, like sharing the resources that I've been learning from, because I mean, I'm very much like if I'm finding a project difficult and I just need to like learn how to do a thing, like I'm still the type of person to pull up a YouTube video and like watch it one-to-one and like do the thing. But like, yeah, it could be as easy as just sharing that instead of making everyone go on that same journey of finding the resource to learn from. And yeah, so it kind of grew from there until like it kind of people started asking about the more prepper things, in which case I kind of tied it into like, you know, prepping for me is a way of life where it's just a continual, small, like marginal process. Like it's not a big, like going out and spending thousands of dollars to get stuff. Like it's something you can develop into just your weekly budget, your monthly budget, whatever. And just building out a plan that's as approachable as you need it to be, even if it's only picking up, you know, spending $4 extra when you go to the grocery store and getting 4 cans of beans to stick away in your pantry. Like that's something. And that's something that week over week compounds. And getting people connected to that mindset, I think, makes prepping seem much less crazy, much less like crazy hoarders. And it shows like, you know, it's something that everyone can do. You don't need to be someone in the woods with a bunch of space and property. Like there's little things that anyone can undertake to just be a little bit more secure. And for me, the people who need that the most are marginalized communities who are really regularly either like directly pushed away from people who are sharing this content or are indirectly pushed away just by the rhetoric that person uses like in their YouTube videos or whatever. Like everyone deserves a safe space to learn. Should be like the most basic thing of society.
No, I really like, it's been a while since I've seen someone making content in this space. There's a lot of good people making content in this space, but I just specifically like right away was really impressed by your attitude around this stuff. And just, I'm saying this partly to anyone who's listening. If you haven't already checked out Dark Winter Concepts on whatever platform you You really should. I think the first stuff that I ran across from you, I'm not 100% certain how I first started running across you. I think it was through Yellow Peril Tactical, who's been on the show before too. But you had a bunch of posts that were like slideshows of, hey, instead of buying another redundant gun. And do you want to talk about that series? And I guess I'm really curious, one, the kind of ideas behind that, and maybe say that to the audience so that the audience can learn it too, but also how people have like reacted to that content.
So that content was, I mean, that was like kind of the transformative content for my channel. Like that was what really kind of took off and what I saw huge interest in. And so what we did, and this is honestly because of Yellow Peril Tactical, because they post so much about like, don't buy redundant guns, buy training, buy, you know, mm-hmm. or don't spend your money, like just train and get good with the one that you have. And so I kind of took that the next step and decided, you know, well, what are some other things like within, I mean, some of the items are a little higher, but within the range of like what you would spend for, you know, the latest optic or whatever you want to like, you know, tactical thing you want. Like, here are 9 things you could buy to better enhance your food preps, or here are 9 things you could buy to mm-hmm. better enhance your ability to conserve and filter water, or like first aid supplies or tech upgrades that you can make that just will upgrade your life more or make your life a little bit better and provide more value to you and your community than to just buy another gun or to buy, you know, another level up of better optic or, you know, the stuff that if you're getting into guns, then you know that it can be an absolute money pit of continual yeah. upgrades and like the coolest thing that you need to get. And it's just like, once you get like a setup, like stop dumping money into it, like learn how to use it and spend that money on things that provide more value in the long term. And we kind of just, I mean, I kind of just pushed that idea out till I kind of ran out of like topics to suggest people spend their money in. But I mean, there's yeah. definitely been a few more. There will probably be some more series like that coming out or extensions on them, because I mean, we get into like medical gear, like there's so many things mm-hmm. that are better, like good to just keep collecting and building up. There's so many more items that people could discuss. So there may just be part twos to every original series.
Okay. Yeah, the money pit of the gun. Recently, I wanted to change the stock on one of my rifles, and it wasn't a fancy thing. I just wanted it was actually in many ways a cheaper stock, right? And I was like, oh, okay, I got this thing. And then I was like, oh, in order to get this thing, I now need to get a new sling mount. And in order to get this new sling mount, I need another different sling mount for this sling mount to attach to. And people always refer to like the AR as like the Lego rifle, but it's like, if the Lego blocks were made out of solid gold, because the sling mount is $15. It's a nut. That's what it is. It yeah. is a nut and a bolt, and it is $15. And that's not high end, right? I don't have high end equipment. I'm not, you know, firearms aren't my like primary interest. They're something I got into because Nazis told me where I lived and that they wanted to kill me, you know? And like, yeah, it's a money pit. That's just all I wanted to say about that.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely is. I mean, and you get into like I got my first suppressor for one like last year, mm-hmm. which was already a big enough okay, like oh, thank you, so excited. Yeah. Like obviously that's already a big enough like expenditure, and then from there I was like, oh yeah, now I need to get a muzzle device that takes suppressor. It's like, oh, well, mm-hmm. I mean, I got the suppressor because I have 2 ARs of the same caliber of like different makes, like different setups. Well, now I need a muzzle mm-hmm. device for both of them. And then it just spirals. Everything just has yeah. so many supporting assets. And it's something you really have to plan out, which that's actually another series that I'm hoping to do, which is like, if you're buying a gun for the first time, like, don't just look at like the sticker price of the thing that you're looking at the store. Here are all these other things yeah. that you should be budgeting for as well. Cause as soon as you get this thing, everyone's going to tell you, you also need a red dot on it and all this other stuff. And just provide a little bit yeah. of like a price. Like if you're planning to invest in this, like here's kind of what you should be budgeting for long-term at least.
I think that some of that stuff is like, I think overall, most of the people who are sort of first into this kind of space, like, you know, lefty community or community defense, community and individual defense type people, right? The people who are excited to do it right now when it's not specifically a crisis will tend to be people who enjoy figuring all of the different pieces out. But then there's also people who are doing it because they're like, well, you know, Nazis with rifles keep coming to the drag show and I need to be a non-Nazi with a rifle outside the drag show before someone dies, you know? And then it's annoying because, like, let's say you want to be that girl, but you don't want to spend the next 6 months of your life learning the names of clips that go on your plate carrier to attach the, I don't remember what it's called, the thing on the front of your plate carrier to the plate carrier itself. You know, like I had that specific problem, right? I was like, oh, I need this thing. And I don't even know what it does this exist? You know, and I had to go track down this like clip. And I actually think there's a really good role. And I think that's something that you do really well. This whole episode is just basically me talking about how great your stuff is and how everyone should check it out. But I think about how like we need quartermasters. We need sometimes people to say, here is a basic loadout. I actually think Yellow Peril Tactical does a really good job of this too, where you're like, if you are choosing to build an IFAC, an individual first aid kit, instead of like everyone having to watch 16 YouTube videos and figure out exactly what to do, it's nice to just be like, here are the 8 things that you need in your IFAC, or even here's an IFAC, you know? And the same, obviously, with like, I mean, I think it's true for like rifles and armor and these, you know, these sorts of things, but it's also true for like water filters and other really basic things.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Absolutely.
I don't know what the name of those clips were. And if I needed them again, I'd be a shit out of luck.
Yeah. It's, I mean, that's, I think that is one of the, like beyond like firearms and all the accessories and all that stuff, I think getting into like nylon, like gear is an even bigger, I mean, it's not as high of a spend, but it is more excess of a spend because you get something and there's nowhere you can go to try it on unless you have friends who already have them. Like there's nowhere you can go to like pick it up, like to like Cabela's or whatever. And like feel a handgun and see how it feels. Like you just order a plate carrier from somewhere, try it out. And it's like, does not feel good, or you give it a good go and it like doesn't feel good. When you try like some new pouches and like balance doesn't feel right. Like you set it up just like that YouTuber that you watch, but like it doesn't work for you. And now suddenly you just have all these pouches and they don't work.
Yeah.
And now you see another pouch that like, oh, like that one's like a little bit smaller and that one would work, but it's like $35. And it's just, it's a really
steal.
Complex. it's such a just complex and not very like talked about thing unless you know the people to go to who are already talking about it, like the people at Yellow Peril Tactical and a few other accounts. I think the more people that can talk about that stuff in detail in different communities, like I have a different audience than Yellow Peril Tactical does, because I have more of like the homesteader side and like people who are looking to like community gardening and that sort of stuff. And so to be able to talk a little bit more about like my own setup, like I posted that the other day for like judge it, like tell me what's wrong with it because I've had it in isolation for too long, but like also an opportunity for people to ask like what is like that pouch under your arm? Like what is like this and that, and an opportunity to kind of talk people through and show in detail, like how it is actually set up. Is something that I think isn't done enough.
Well, okay. Talking about having like a slightly different audience than say, for example, Yellow Peril, like I want to ask about that. I remember at one point you posted something about carrying Narcan and how Narcan is an important part of everyday carry. And I think that this is true. I can get kind of slack on it myself, but now I keep it in my vehicle. Although if you keep it in your vehicle, you have to refresh it way more often. Because it doesn't like temperature extremes. Like, just think about it. If you travel with condoms, think about it like condoms. You have to change them out if they're in places that are not climate controlled. And And you said that you got a lot of pushback, or like at least some people were like piping up. Like, you clearly, Yellow Peril Tactical antagonizes the right wing and speaks very clearly to the anti-authoritarian left, right? Because they also antagonize the, this is part of why I love them. They also antagonize the authoritarian left. And your content is more broadly faced. And I actually really like that about it. But I'm curious how, like, how much pushback you get when you even say things like, because it's like secretly a leftist thing to say carry Narcan. It shouldn't be, right? It shouldn't be a political statement to say, like, hey, you call yourself a fucking sheepdog. That sheep is overdosing. What are you doing? You know? Anyway, I'm just curious what the, how navigating that space is going for you, being in a more wider facing audience.
It's been, I mean, overall really positive. There's definitely a little bit of pushback on, I mean, the Narcan was the like most pushback I've ever gotten on anything I've ever said, on social media. Like, people just jumped into the comments, like, one, like, people saying that they should ban production Narcan because it just enables the druggies, and just like all of the most just like heinous, unempathetic shit that people say, and because they have been so dehumanized. I mean, people who struggle with addiction have been so dehumanized for this entire political area, that people view them as disposable. And I mean, thankfully, like, I mean, there are a couple of people that I jumped in on, but then there are other people who came into the comments and are like, yeah, kind of did the work for me, which is great. Like, I love to be able to, like, yes, fight, like, get them. Like, it's that kind of just good relief of like, oh, okay, I'm not completely alone out here. But overall, it has been really intentional to keep it open-ended, where I don't put labels on my beliefs. I've pretty rarely verbally define myself as a leftist. Just for the sense that I think most of the people that we have the opportunity to pull more left are people who to this point have been, you know, they have lived comfortably like liberal or kind of actual, well, I say centrist as being like someone who's in between just being a Democrat and Republican. So I know that's still well right of center, but kind of people in that area, like, they're not, they haven't fallen off the far right cliff. But people who are starting to wake up to the fact that the world is not in a great spot, that society isn't invulnerable, that their position of comfort is not invulnerable. And they're starting to just reach out for answers. And I see it as a huge opportunity, which, I mean, one, being in a leftist space and not verbally, like, verbalizing that, I don't come off as like a radical or anything. I try not to be putting off in that way, and just like bringing people into the ideas. Because, I mean, it's one of those things where, like, if you describe like anarchists, like their actual beliefs to someone, like in a lot of cases, they're like, oh yeah, like that makes a lot of sense. But then as soon as you tell them that you're an anarchist, they're like, oh, well, I could never, like, you know, it's the label that scares them. And so keeping it a little bit more open, getting people just into the ideas, into the topics when they reach out is huge for me. Because, I mean, you've probably seen it on the other side of the prepping community. It's like a whole meme about like laughing when someone says that they're going to come to your house when shit hits the fan. It's like, that's why I'm prepping, so that people know they can come to my house when shit hits the fan. Like, that is my biggest motivation, is to be able to help people who weren't as prepared or didn't have the privilege to be as prepared as I am. And so it's an opportunity where the right is pushing people away, and we can welcome them with open arms and, you know, actual education, and be as welcoming as possible. And through that, kind of sprinkle in some ideas of like community involvement and some general kind of anarchist overtones, autonomous collectives of community and being responsible for our own resources. And people can usually get on board with a lot of those things, and it just sprinkles in, plants the seed. And then if they stick around, if they find other people that I follow and other stuff that I share, it just starts the process of radicalization.
No, yeah. I think about my place within that funnel all of the time. And I think about it in some ways positively, and I also think about it cynically, right? Because I don't wake up in the morning being like, time to do my propaganda, right? You know, like, I think about how my goal is to, like, help people survive things and take care of each other, you know? And I think it's useful to bring people towards, you know, it means less like about bringing people towards, for me, anarchism, right? But it's more about breaking the conceptions that people have about what must be involved in being a leftist, you know? Like, in some ways, my, like, no, I don't fuck with authoritarianism is the more important part of my politics when I'm talking to people. You know, I think about how around here, the way I would describe myself to most people is that I'm just like, look, one of the reasons I like living where I live is that overall the vibe around here is you leave each other alone and you take care of each other. And I know it sounds contradictory, but everyone I know who lives around here, this is not a contradictory thing. Like, we by and large stay out of each other's business, but my neighbor noticed when I was out of town and there was a big windstorm, hey, do you want me to go check to make sure no tree fell on your house? You know? And like, yeah. That person doesn't have a political label. And if they do, it probably wouldn't agree with mine. But like, yeah, I don't know. But the basic ideas of take care of each other and leave each other alone. I mean, like, to me, that's what I like about anarchism is that you're like, oh, well, the individual and the community. And what you're saying about when I found that thing, the jokes in the right wing prepper space about like, oh, anyone who comes over to my house is getting shot. You know, imagine how I feel sad for them because their entire social community is people saying we're only friends until the buzzer starts. You know, it's like they're all trying to play Hunger Games and they're being buddy-buddy with everyone else who signed up to play Hunger Games. And like, what a terrible and sad thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It lets you know kind of how lonely a lot of people really are, like how little they actually care about other people, which I mean, is its own form of loneliness beyond like, you know, spending time with people, blah, blah, blah. But like if your first instinct for a disaster is to like, lock the doors, board up the windows, and you know, sit there with your can of beans in the corner, and you know, shoot anyone who knocks on the door. Yeah. Like, what does that mean for like the rest of your life? You've literally built no connections with other people that you value beyond like your own immediate needs. It's very sad.
Have you noticed, like? And maybe it's just because like some of the bigger online spaces like the Reddit or Prepper or Preppers or whatever it is, the main one, have been more community focused lately. I've been noticing this thing where I actually think that the prepping community is now no longer right wing or rather no longer far right and values both individual and community preparedness. Like it feels like that's a fight we're winning culturally. Like I have no interest in making preppers share my politics. I have interest in people realizing that community preparedness is a big part of preparedness. And it seems like we're kind of winning there maybe.
Yeah. I think that has come with prepping becoming so much more mainstream. I mean, the response to even just like the movie, Leave the World Behind.
Is that the Obama one?
If you watch it, I thought it was really well done as in a way of just like the absolute hopelessness of people who in no way prepared or even conceived that something could go wrong. And there were a lot of people who were like, so I just watched this movie. What do I need to buy? I need a go bag. I need like it just kind of woke them up to like even in like the early, like before all the crazy, like, stuff happened, like the invasion or whatever, just like the disaster of like 2 days without cell phones, and people realizing that, like,
yeah,
like, yeah, that's like, it kind of happened to some people yesterday, literally. You know, that's something that is waking a lot of people up, and waking them up to the idea that, like, prepping doesn't have to be doomsday preppers, you know, reality show.
Right.
It can just be having a radio. It can just be having extra food. And so people are, looking out and expanding. One of my, I honestly just found it, which is a Reddit thread, R2X Preppers, which is a prepping community that prioritizes the voices of women. And it's wild how drastic, like, the concerns are. Because, I mean, like, drastically different. Whereas, like, I mean, biggest conversations around, like, how do you prep when you have kids? Like, how do you prep? Like, what's your go bag look like when you have to, like, also bring their stuff? And, like, actual, like, family-oriented things rather than, like, rugged individualism. Like, I found that the conversations over there have been so much more based in reality than a lot of other ones, which has been really cool. And again, cool to see that, like, again, from a community standpoint, like, people are connecting. Like, people are looking for other people who know things. People are looking for people to help. And they're realizing that they can't do it alone.
I admit. Okay. So the name 2X Prepping makes me sad, but not, not sad as in, like, oh, they inherently hate trans women. I would guess, I've never really looked at this subreddit. I've only heard about it very recently. I would guess that it is, like, not a group of people who's, like, taken a stance against trans women as much as, like, cis women organizing, and the overwhelming majority of women identify as having 2X chromosomes. No one's actually looked at their chromosomes, but, like, you know, like, karyotyping does not happen to kids. But, and then I get sad when I think about it, partly because I'm like, oh, that conversation will be very hard. It'll be very hard to have that conversation in a way that won't make those women defensive. Not necessarily all of them. I'm sure some of them be, you know, it, I don't know, whatever. But that's a separate topic about how I'm currently sad about the, like, slow creep over from England of anti-trans rhetoric within feminist spaces. But, like, and I'm not making any, like, again, it sounds like an amazing resource, and just, like, they picked a name that absolutely made sense to them. And then I'm like, oh, this is going to be awkward. This is going to be one of those conversations that's, like, hard and annoying to have.
I will say it very much seems that they made the community, like whenever you open it up, like, there's, like the note that you read before you, like, go down the thing, and it's like, men read this first, and just, like, basic, like, guidelines, like, don't come in and, like, talk over the people who are talking here. Don't, like, basically don't act the way that the stereotypical right-wing prepper man acts in the prepper space. And it's, like, really good guidelines for, like, basically just allow people to talk and discover and discuss, and, like, don't try to be the dominant voice in this channel.
Yeah. No, that's cool. Okay. Wait, I have a bunch of other things that I wanted to ask you about. Okay. So, we've talked separately and unrelatedly to anything else about how we both play video games. And that's not, and then when you were mentioning about how you plan to help people, like, you plan to prep in order to take people in, like, so you hope that people come over. I'm curious. I just want to run something past you, basically. One of the things that has made me realize that, I mean, I've never had a particularly strong, like, bunker mentality. It's never been my approach to anything. But one of the things that's, like, really reinforced my belief in community preparedness is the lesson of, I play strategy games all the time. And in strategy games, you, like, you want more, it's okay to have more resources, but what you want is more things that generate resources, right? And that's people. So I can't imagine, like, small countries don't have as high gross domestic product as big countries, because people are what make things. Like, the idea that I alone, or with my, like, immediate family, like, that that's a useful unit to approach the apocalypse doesn't make any sense to me. And I don't know. Where am I going with this? It's like people think of, oh, you want to let people in and eat your stockpiles. That's you showing weakness. And they're going to see your weakness and take advantage of it. But everything I've ever learned about strategy says that it's actually a strategic plan. I mean, it's also a basic empathy, but like,
yeah,
I don't know. I just want to run that idea past you. If you have any thoughts on it.
Yeah. Yeah. This is something I actually talked about like really recently, which was that, like one in most scenarios, like the right wing has painted the idea of the leftist prepper as like walking down the street, like throwing food to the masses, like just giving away all your stuff. And that's not the plan at all. Like, I mean, with being able to bring people here, it's because, I mean, currently I have way more space than I could ever reasonably cultivate food on. Like I can certainly cultivate a lot, but like if people were to show up and like, you know, need food, like, and need a place to stay, that is, again, like you said, like a strategic, like strategy game is like recruiting people to your town to put to tasks and to be able to exchange, you know, your resources that you've been collecting in exchange for some of their time. And if they're going to be staying there, just like to contribute to the community as a whole. Because when it comes down to it, I mean, if you're going even down the rabbit hole of like defense, like I think a lot of people have talked about, like, you need more than your like immediate family to like just keep watch. Like you need someone who can like keep watch at night while other people sleep. But, you know, it's like the more people you have, the more it's a force multiplier. I think it's a force multiplier because you can just generate so much more, so many more resources, build your infrastructure up so much faster with those additional people.
Yeah, no, totally. And it like, and then I think the other thing that I run across a lot is that a lot of people don't think that they have anything to offer. And I actually think that one of the things that behooves us in our process of like anti-gatekeeping is helping people realize what they have to offer, which might not be physical labor, right? Like some people for various reasons can't do physical labor, right? But there's like, it seems like the overwhelming majority of people have something that they can offer. And then if there's every now and then people who don't have anything to offer, well, you know what? That's fine. Like, okay. Like if one person out of 50 can't contribute anything, well, great. You can still stick around because overall bringing people in, because it's like less about like, oh, you come in and now you're going to be like, you slot into this role and now you're the person who goes and gardens all day. Or I play enough video games where like, you're not the person who carries the thing from the garden to the kitchen or whatever, right? But instead, you know, people always like the right wing always talks about how like, oh, well, hungry people will do anything to fix that problem. And you're like, yeah, one of the things that they'll do is productive labor. Like, one of the things that you can do is you can all wake up in the morning and be like, these are the problems we're facing. How can we confront them and get people to volunteer to do the things? Because that works, because if people know that they have it's that or go hungry, they will do it. And not because you're going to make them starve, but because, I don't know, whatever.
That's something that I actually feel really, really strongly about, with making people feel included in communities and not making people feel included, finding ways to include people. It's not about like making them just like feel good, but like, you know, giving them an actual place within your community, even if it's not like quote unquote productive, like, or like labor.
Yeah.
Like there's always something that someone can do to help, whatever that may be. Or if they are someone who, you know, their primary role, you know, if they're someone who just has an extreme disability, you know, it's like physically, like they just cannot like quote unquote contribute. But like having people around, having people who are around who are different from you is incredibly valuable. And like, I always look at it from the perspective of like, even if my neighbor like has no construction skills, like no hands-on skills, like no labor potential, like, you know, they are disabled, but like they work as a remote like project manager. like being a project manager when it comes to like organizing a bunch of people onto tasks, like that's wildly useful. Or if you are just like, I work in like communications, and like, I don't know how, like learning how to like communicate ideas that like I am really good at coming up with ideas. It's much harder for me to like distill them down into like verbiage that someone who doesn't have extreme ADHD can understand. Like having someone
shout
to
out to everyone listening to this at 2x speed. Sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah, like that's really it. And it also comes down, like, even if you're not, like, you don't know what role you're in, you don't know what role you can do, like, it doesn't, you don't have to look at it from the perspective of like you need to have a function. Like maybe your function is just to help other people do their function. You know, maybe it is just bringing water to people who are laboring outside. Maybe it's just kind of like reading the recipe to someone who's cooking for everyone else. Like there's always something that can make other people's role easier. And again, like you said, for the people that like, they can't contribute in that way. Like that's also fine. Like those are the people that the rest of us need to be contributing to take care of. Like there are people who just need, like they need support, they need help. And that's what community should be all about. It's not about a meritocracy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I want to have you on to talk about so much more, but for now, is there anything that, you know, questions you wished I had asked or final thoughts around these particular topics, or even if you just want to like talk a little bit about something you have coming up with? Oh, also, where's the name Dark Winter Concepts come from? I have no idea. You mentioned some game maybe, but so that, and then any other final thoughts?
So the name Dark Winter Concepts is related to The Division, but it is something that happened in the real world. Operation Dark Winter was a simulation that the United States government ran in partnership with Johns Hopkins to simulate a bioweapon attack in, I think, Oklahoma City in 2001. Mm-hmm. Basically, like to run a simulation like this happened, like this is how it's spreading. I think they used smallpox as the example. And then used Johns Hopkins as like a like hospital response, medical response, like emergency. How do we like respond to this in real time, basically? And we failed like really bad. Like it fell apart really, really fast. And as we saw 20 years later, we learned nothing from that failure as we once again were faced with a viral incident. And as a nation or as a national response, not as the people within, like the national response fell flat and was, you know, a day late and a buck short. And so I wanted to pull on that with the concepts at the end, which is really just about providing the ideas and information that people can then take to help bridge that gap, you know, to help bridge the gap between, you know, when things go wrong, when there's a disaster, like you have to kind of expect to be your first, like your first responder, like the whole, like, you know, expect to self-rescue or whatever. But basically like, you can't rely on an immediate government response to like help. Like you need to be able to cover that 2 or 3 days or a week until, you know, the National Guard can come in or FEMA's there or whatever, like just to like stay alive and keep other people around you alive long enough to like get the help that will hopefully come. And so that's kind of where the motivation for the name came, which was just like recognition of like, we're still not going to learn anything. Like even after 2020 and everything else, like I would fully expect the same thing to happen next time. It's all of our systems that are privatized are going to be run bare minimum. They are not able to, the specific note from Operation Dark Winter was the healthcare system's inability to scale to meet the need. It was like the big failing point. Like hospitals were not able to scale because they are all chronically understaffed. They are all chronically underfunded. They do not have like excess medicine isn't just being made because it's the right thing to do. Like, it's not something that has been fixed and doesn't seem to be a priority to be fixed.
And that's, you know, when I talk about how individual and community preparedness are not in opposition, but directly related and like synergize. I never use the word synergize, but I'm going to use it right now. That to me is like such a clear example of it, right? Like they expect to self-rescue. They expect, like, I'm not a hospital, right? I am a squeamish person who drags myself into medical workshops kicking and screaming. but I still do it every now and then, right? Because I'm like, the more diffused this knowledge is, the more that the super specialized people can like focus on that. I talk a lot with one of my friends who's a medical professional, is a physician's assistant, and he talks about how he now I'm combining a couple different in my head, a couple of my different medical profession friends, and they talk about how like now that they like work in hospitals, they're less likely to do street medic stuff, partly because they're like the part of their brain that is used to helping people gets used up when they're like sawing people's legs off and like doing this like higher level of care work, where walking around and giving people sunscreen and like reminding people to drink water and maybe being around to like flush someone's eyes out is like, don't get me wrong, like shout out to all the nurses and doctors who still do street medic stuff. But the more people can pick up that slack so that the people who specialize in the thing can do the higher level of care thing. And then my squeamish self can still handle most level of wounds that I can do to myself, you know, like I'm sure if I chainsaw deep enough into my leg, I need higher level of care, but overall the average wound that I do to myself in the course of my life as doing woodworking or whatever, I can handle because I learned this stuff. And so I'm just rambling about the, no, I really like this. I like what you're talking about. Okay. Well, how can people find you if they want to learn more? Is there any like specific kinds of support you're looking for or anything like that?
So I am just Dark Winter Concepts on Instagram and TikTok primarily. TikTok a little bit more heavily just due to engagement over there right now. But any platform, I'm over on YouTube as well, but not as much. There will also be a website that by the time this airs should be live as well, just darkwinterconcepts.com. It is just like for my day job is a brand designer. So the ability to actually like design shit that I care about was just an opportunity, but it's also something that like, I don't want people to like buy a shirt that they don't like just because they want to support me. But there will be like some cool, like original like shirts and mugs and flags and stuff. That's just like all my own designs, just all my own stuff. If people want to promote what I'm doing, if people want to support through that shop, or just come and engage on any social media platform, that is by far the most rewarding thing. People just drop into an Instagram post and leave a comment, ask a question. Answering the individual questions is the most rewarding part of any of this. So Dark Winter Concepts on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Facebook even. I'm all around.
Hell yeah. Well, thanks so much, and we'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, go check out Dark Winter Concepts. And also, if you want to support this podcast, you can do so by supporting us on Patreon, or, you know, telling people about it is really good too. But you can support us on Patreon through our publisher, which is Strangers in a Tangled Wilderness. We put out a lot of different stuff, and including two other podcasts that you might want to check out. One is called The Spectacle. We renamed Anarcho Geek Power Hour to The Spectacle, just probably a better name, I'm willing to admit, even though they, whatever. And also the podcast Strangers in a Tangled Wilderness, which is, we put out a new zine every month. And if you want that zine, and it ends up on the podcast, but if you want that zine in the mail, you can support us on Patreon. It's patreon.com/strangers-in-a-tangled-wilderness. Oh, and then anyone who supports at the $20 a month level, not only will I read out your name, but I'll also read out kind of whatever you tell me to, within some limits. And so often we are going to be shouting out a couple projects that support us. And so, yeah, that's a thing that you can do. We want to thank Amber and Ephemeral Appalachian. Appalachian. They specifically made a note about how you can't say Appalachian. And I was like, I would never do that. I didn't grow up saying that. But I was looking at that note when I started reading it. I'm so terribly sorry, Appalachian Liberation Library. Portland's Hedron Hackerspace, Boldfield, E, Patuli, Eric, Buck, Julia, Catgut, Marm, Carson, Lord Harkin, Trickster, Princess Miranda, Ben Ben, Anonymous, Funder, Janice and Odell, Allie, Papa Runa, Milica, Boise Mutual Aid, Theo, Hunter, SJ, Paige, Nicole, David, Dana, Chelsea, Starro, Jennifer, Kirk, Chris, Micaiah, and of course, the immortal Hoss the Dog. All right. I will talk to you all soon, and I hope you all are doing as well as you can with everything that's happening.